Hello, and welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We release these episodes every week on Wednesday mornings, and the best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you are listening. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via Venmo by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can make a donation through our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, by clicking the Donate tab. Peace and love. Hope you enjoy.
Move into the talk today. We're doing a series of talks on something called the three marks of existence, or the three characteristics. And they are anicca, dukkha, and anatta, which roughly translate to mean impermanence, stressfulness, and not self. And it's interesting because if you look at the suttas, if you look at the Buddhist teachings, there's not a whole lot of discrete teachings on the three marks. There are a couple where he talks about all of them explicitly, but I would say every teaching that the Buddha offers is on the three marks. Some people may say that it's really the essence, it's really the kind of core wisdom that the Buddha is offering us to take a look at. And so that's the other cool thing about the three marks and a lot of what we're here to do as meditators, as people that are maybe interested in the mind and the body and this being human, is that the Buddha is offering practices, not beliefs. It's really hard for the Western mind to break out of that conditioning. You know, it's really hard for the mind to break out of that conditioning. That there's this idea that if I actually understand these great wisdom practices of the world, if I study them and read them in books and, you know, learn all of the links of dependent origination and the Diamond Sutra on emptiness, if I really get in there, then I will find peace and happiness. And the Buddha is both kind of validating us and making it harder for us at the same time, where he's saying, you don't have to learn any of that shit. The Buddha wasn't a Buddhist, right? Buddha means awakened. And so Buddhism is wake-up-ism. And if you look through all the suttas and you look through all the teachings that the Buddha offered, there are so many more verbs than there are nouns in the teaching. It's not believe in emptiness, it's investigate and see. Is there any substantial nature to your thoughts, to the body sensations, to the feeling tones that you're experiencing? So the wisdom we're trying to develop through meditation is experiential in nature. And like I said during the Q&A, is that it's a process of seeing and studying and observing what's happening on the inside. You know, it's an interesting thing because so much is actually happening on the inside. I don't know if you've noticed that. But it's not always the thing that I'm talking about or even really aware of myself a lot of the time. You know, sometimes it's not until I walk into my therapist's office that I'm like, oh shit, I didn't know how angry I was about that, right? And I'm supposed to be a meditator here. So we're not always actually really aware of what's occurring and what's happening in our mind and in our body. And so the unpleasant thing that the Buddha is asking of us is he's saying, well, if you want more peace and happiness in life, you got to sit down and look. And that it's not a belief thing, it's a cultivation thing. There's actually no word for meditation in Pali Sanskrit, in the language that the Buddha's teachings were recorded in. There's no word for meditation. That's an 18th century word, much later. The Buddha lived in 400, 480, somewhere around there, BC. This is a long time before that word came along. The word that the Buddha uses is bhavana, which means cultivation. It's cultivating this awareness, cultivating this quality of understanding and compassion and appreciative joy and loving kindness and equanimity. We're really here to practice, not to perfect, not to intellectually understand. So in that, the Buddha says, come and see for yourself. These three marks of existence I'm about to review, these are things that you shouldn't believe and take at face value. These are things that you can start to investigate and be curious about. Do you notice in this human experience, the first, that your life, being human, is inconstant? There's no ground to it. It's never the same. It's always in flow, in flux. And if we zoom out, we can say, oh yeah, you know, everything changes. I always joke that that's like an easy bumper sticker to slap on the car. The only constant in life is change. I think of one of my favorite songs, excuse my language here, by anyone a fan of Nas? It's an album, Illmatic, one of the best hip-hop albums of all time, in my opinion. He has a song called Life's a Bitch, and he says, life's a bitch, and then you die. That's why we get high, because you never know when you're going to go. So even Nas knows about impermanence, right? But the question is not do we know about impermanence, it's do we remember it in the moments where we're wanting it to be otherwise. You know, in the moment where you're losing the job, or where you're planning a move across the country, or where you're breaking up from a relationship, do we remember, oh yeah, right now it's like this, I can open to this experience of change with compassion instead of grasping. And the Buddha says, again, for us to examine, not as a belief, that anytime there's clinging, there's suffering. Anytime we're holding on to something that is changing, there's suffering. And I wish I could just learn this once and be done. You know, I mean, it's really humbling and it's really irritating, especially as a Buddhist teacher, to be still going to like my communities and being like, yeah, I'm not accepting this thing and I want to accept it, but just I'm not getting it in here. I'm fighting it. I hate it. I hate this change. And so the practice here is to embrace our process of change, of acceptance. Because it doesn't happen overnight, but as we're intimate with what's happening, we can say, oh, okay, cool. No big deal. Practice the humility of, I'm fighting it. Great, that's where I'm at right now. So notice that. How does it feel? So impermanence, life is inconstant. And I like that definition, inconstancy. You know, it's not good or bad. It's not joy or sorrow all of the time. It's not always praise. It's not always blame. It's not always pleasure. It's not always pain. It's actually all of these things, all of the time. And so what's it like to be in a world that's inconstant? It's hard. That's the second characteristic, dukkha. It's stressful. The Buddha's dying words when he was on his deathbed, there's a really beautiful sutta. I think it's called The Island, or there's a famous quote in it about being an island unto yourself. You know, because all of the Buddha's followers were like, what are we going to do? Who are we going to follow now that you're dying? And he's like, haven't you been listening? It's not about following anyone other than yourself. But at the very end of the sutta, he says something really beautiful. So these are the Buddha's dying words. He says, all conditioned things are impermanent, inconstant. Tread the path with care. So what does this mean in terms of, I should say this, one of the things I really appreciate about Buddhism is that it includes meditation. There is actually a training, there's a practice that I can undertake that helps me understand impermanence. It helps me get used to it. It helps me get in the water and warm up to it. Because as you're sitting there in meditation, you may notice a thought arises, a thought passes. Pain arises in the body, pain passes. You start to notice, especially if you put in a few hours of this, it doesn't even take that long to notice that a lot of what we're doing is trying to sit back into the flow of experience, not trying to control or manage or change it to be any other way than the way that it is right now. And intellectually, that idea makes sense, but experientially, we're trying to get the heart. Buddha calls this citta, your human receptivity on board. And you could look at the field of neuroscience and say, okay, yeah, they validated this. Mindfulness helps you expand your window of tolerance. So you actually can measure what the Buddha called equanimity or acceptance. And that's helpful. It's like, okay, great. We're probably doing something pretty good for ourselves. And it's a beautiful thing when we can actually come moment to moment into this actual experience of impermanence, where we can start to really work with it in real time. Whatever you practice, you get better at. You can practice an instrument, get good at an instrument, practice public speaking, get good at public speaking. Well, you can also practice accepting impermanence through meditation. It's pretty cool. So I want to read a quote by Ferrier. Sounds like a super smart person. And is a very smart person. I believe they were a professor. I'm not quite sure. But they wrote this essay on, it's called Lectures and Remains. So I want you to imagine that you're at a sunset. I think this is a really good, relatable experience of impermanence. I want you to imagine that you're at a sunset as I read this. Suppose yourself gazing on a gorgeous sunset. The whole western heavens are glowing with roseate hues, but you are aware that within half an hour, all those glorious tints will have faded away into a dull ashen gray. You see them even now melting away before your eyes as you watch. Although your eyes cannot quite place before you the conclusion which your reason draws. And what conclusion is that? That conclusion is that you never, even for the shortest time that can be named or conceived, see any abiding or lasting color in the sunset. Any color which truly is. Within the millionth part of a second, the whole glory of the painted heavens has undergone an incalculable series of mutations. One shade is supplanted by another with a rapidity which sets all measurements at defiance. But because the process is one to which no measurements apply, reason refuses to lay an arrestment on any period of the passing scene or to declare that it is, because in the very act of being, it is not. It has given place to something else. It is a series of fleeting colors, the sunset. no one of which is, because each of them continually vanishes into another. Have you ever watched a sunset? Do you ever have that feeling? I usually have it after, when it turns dark. Just how much the world changed in a matter of minutes. And almost how I couldn't even quite watch it change. It just seemed like one moment it was sunny, orange, red, green, purple, whatever colors are in a sunset. And the next moment it was dark. And we inhabit a changing landscape. There are only transient, momentary experiences. In meditation, we practice this. We notice the arising and passing of thoughts and feelings, sensations before our very eyes. You may notice that as soon as you're aware of a thought, the thought may disappear. You may notice that you woke up in a bad mood, and then at some point throughout the day, just like the sunset, your mood changed. And you're not quite sure why or how or what led to it, but it did. So I want to talk a little bit about observing impermanence through meditation. And one of the ways that the Buddha offers for us to practice is with the four foundations of mindfulness. You'll see on the board that I crossed out four, and we're just going for three today. When we look at the body, one of the things that comes up is, I think for a lot of us, is just how uncomfortable it is to have a body. You know, and I think for a lot of us, what comes up is how often we wish our bodies were other than the way that they are. You know, when you're young, the body is really good at regenerating itself, healing itself. My daughter was born with a broken clavicle, and we went to the Vandy orthopedic kids doctor, and they said, oh yeah, you don't really have to do anything, it will just heal itself. No sling, no physical therapy, just broken clavicle, just chilling out in the world, it's just going to get better all by itself. The body's really good at regenerating itself, and at some point, I'm not quite sure when it happens, but at some point, you just kind of like, you know, sustain an injury sleeping in the middle of the night somehow. It's like 2-3 days of constant physical therapy to just try to get the body back in order, right? This is the nature of the body. The nature of the body is that it's aging, and it's actually aging every moment, moment to moment. So one of the things I think we suffer a lot about with when we talk about the body is our body image. There's a Buddhist teacher I really enjoy named Tenisiro Bhikkhu. He's probably written more on Buddhism than any other person alive. And I heard him give a talk one time on body image. I was like, oh, this is really interesting. A monk is talking about body image. What is he going to say? And he said that actually, he said the Buddha wants us to have he says that there is a healthy positive body image and a healthy negative body image. And then he said, there's also an unhealthy positive body image and an unhealthy negative body image. The unhealthy positive body image is when we become quite enamored, idealizing and fantasizing after the physical form. the mind that's kind of caught up in obsession. There's a difference between sexual desire, which is human, healthy. Buddha calls desire an ethically neutral mental factor, which means having desire can go any direction. It can go in an unhealthy direction. It can go in a healthy direction. But when desire, when sexual desire goes in an unhealthy direction, it's oftentimes based in a lot of fantasy, isn't it? It's based in a lot of reactivity and longing, insatiable thirst. Come on, some of y'all went through puberty, right? And so he calls this an unhealthy positive, where we see the body as beautiful, but we kind of lose our ground. We lose a healthy groundedness to it, and we become caught up in the chase, in the mental obsession. And any of y'all that have had this experience of mental obsession around sexuality, is it's actually quite frustrating. The mind creates in just a moment of a second an idealized fantasy of someone, and then it plays it out in its head, and then because that fantasy is not reality, it's not going to go anywhere. Or even worse, we think it's going to go anywhere and we try to act on it, and then it usually goes even worse. Right? When it comes from a reactive place, when it comes from an obsessive place. So that's what he calls an unhealthy positive. In contrast, a healthy positive body image that Tanisara Bhikkhu says the Buddha is really asking us to practice is to notice the utility of the body, how actually amazingly beautiful it is in its design. In its design. You know, that it, you know, walks us around all day, that it breathes all by itself, that even if you pass out, your body will start breathing for you, that the blood pumps through your veins or arteries, or I'm not a medical person, you know, that your body does all of these wonderful things, and that also it can support us in our spiritual life. That's really the thing that the Buddha talks about the most. It's how can we actually care for the body and treat it simply? You know, it's really interesting because the modern world is really obsessed with forming the body, and this goes into the unhealthy negative body image. Is this kind of idea that bodies should be a certain way? There's a certain aesthetic of beauty. And we suffer a lot over that, don't we? And a lot of that is kind of wrapped up in this wellness culture. It's like, well, you can, you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, you can lose weight. If you do X, Y, and Z, you won't get old. You won't have wrinkles. You'll, you know, so on and so forth. And it's all kind of with this intention of not really listening to what the body needs, but trying to kind of force the body into what we want it to be. There's not a lot of intuitiveness around how we treat our bodies. I've noticed this too with things that work for my body, exercise routines, you know, foods that I eat, things like that, is I'll find something that works really well for a period of time and then it changes. Unhealthy negative body image is when you see other people's bodies as being beautiful and yours is not. And have you noticed the mental suffering around that? And the Buddha then offers, or Tanisara Bhikkhu, I should say, says that the Buddha is also asking us to have a healthy negative image of the body. And that is just to realize that everybody's body is actually made up of the same things. Every body is made up of the same things. Sure, some of the chemicals are maybe different. Some people maybe have some different bones than others, but I'm talking about it like the elemental level, right? And this isn't for the purpose of disgust, but it's just to see it for what it is, as we can have more acceptance and also awaken into this insight of the universality of bodies, of having a body. And I'll tell you all one insight that I had on a Zen retreat one time that really helped me with this. It wasn't so much I was getting caught in comparing my body and how I looked to other people, but I was sitting a Zen retreat with Brad Warner when he came to Against the Stream years back. It was the first time I'd sat a retreat with my eyes open. In our tradition, we usually close our eyes. And I was instructed to practice with my eyes open, so I was like, all right, I'll give that a shot. And I had my eyes open, and throughout the day of retreat, there was a lot of sitting meditation, 45-minute, hour-long sitting meditation sessions. And there's a lot of physical pain and discomfort that you experience when you sit for that long. And one of the really beautiful insights, again, something that's hard to articulate, right? But is that I had this experience of so much pain and agony in my body. And then almost as my meditation object, I was staring at the back of someone in front of me. Usually Zazen, you stare at the wall, but we were all sitting in rows. And I was watching this person in front of me, their body just aching, slouching, and then picking it back up, and slouching and picking it back up. And there was this kind of moment of awareness where the personal nature of the body kind of fell away. And I had this experience that the pain that I was feeling was shared, and that it wasn't my pain, that we were kind of in this together. And again, I could intellectually say that and it wouldn't help me, but I had this kind of deep awareness that this pain that I was experiencing is the nature of the body. It's not me, it's not mine, it doesn't mean I'm a bad meditator, it doesn't mean that my leg's gonna fall off, it doesn't mean all of these stories and things, that I could actually just almost surrender in that moment to it and embrace it. Here we are sitting together in pain. And it's almost like this deep bow of appreciation to the Sangha, to the community. So as we practice through meditation, looking into the body, we see the changing nature of sensation. It's kind of the domain of the first foundation, is looking into sensation. Like your comment earlier, when we talk about anxiety, well, what is anxiety? Maybe mental worry? Sure, that's a part of it, but how does it feel in the body? Tension, tightness in the chest, energy in the core of the body. So what if we become, rather than just caught into labels around some of these things, more curious about the sensations? And then you can track and notice the impermanence. Anxiety is actually like this rocking wave of the ocean. Impermanence of feeling tone from the body. There's this arising of the sense of pleasantness or unpleasantness, or neither pleasant or unpleasant in the body. What do we tend to do when we're in a moment that's unpleasant? Cry?
Resist it.
Resist?
Rage.
Rage?
Label.
Say what?
Label it.
Label? Nice.
Mask it.
Someone else?
Mask it.
Mask it?
Escape.
Escape it? Yeah. We know this one well, right? And so it's actually really radical what the Buddha's encouraging here, is to notice it. And to say, unpleasantness is in the body. And to soften around it rather than to resist it And if we do resist it, to not resist our resistance around it, right? Sometimes you gotta get in where you fit in around here. You gotta jump into the equanimity practice wherever you can. So you notice an unpleasant experience, you're like, fuck, I hate this. Excuse my language. That's actually what I would say, though, so excuse my language. And then you're like, oh, I'm not supposed to be hating this. Now I'm hating that I'm hating this. I'm so bad at this. And it's like just proliferation. Unpleasantness now has three arrows on top of it. It's no longer just the second arrow. It's the third. It's the fourth. And so wherever we catch ourselves in that, we just say, oh, okay. Unpleasantness. And what is the response? What's the wise response to unpleasantness is to try to open with compassion. And this is really radical too. Well, what is compassion? Does compassion fix it? I call compassion the unsolvable math problem. Compassion is not about feeling better. It's actually being willing to feel what's not so good. So I think, for me at least, compassion is not a pleasant experience. Maybe mentally, it's nice. There's some kind of sense of, oh, this is the right direction. But usually it's actually coming into a close intimacy with the unpleasantness. So during meditation, we just do that. We just try to come into close intimacy with the unpleasantness that we experience. And what is our relationship to pleasure usually? Want more? Say what?
Grasping.
Yeah, I have this other subtle one that's actually more insidious for me. There's grasping, there's craving, of course. But I actually, my mind tends to think when things are pleasant that this is the way it should be all the time. My mind thinks pleasantness is normal. And so when things are pleasant, I'm like, all right, cool. That's how it should be. And so there's actually, for me, no real appreciation of pleasure either. And so the Buddha's encouraging us to practice this kind of, yeah, non-attachment, not grasping, not craving, but also this non-attached appreciation of like, oh, wow, that's a really great feeling when that person said that thing to me, or when I am having that experience, or when my mind's calm in the meditation practice. Oh, that's a really good feeling. It's not permanent, but I can hang out with it as long as it's here. I think I actually have more of a dysfunctional relationship to pleasure than I do pain. Because a lot of times I don't want to feel it and experience it because I, you know, don't want it to go away. So I can't fully be present for it. All right, last not least, we look at our mind, the impermanence of mind states and thoughts. And I won't say a whole lot about this, but one of the things that, you know, really in the Buddhist teaching on Buddhist psychology, the links of dependent origination, that a lot of the freedom we experience comes between feeling tone and our mind state. Because when things are unpleasant, we resist. The mind becomes agitated. The mind sometimes becomes angry and enthralled in a story about a resentment we have, right? The mind usually jumps off out of feeling into what the Buddha calls mental proliferation, papancha. It's a really great word, papancha, popcorn mind. And so we can also notice when our mind is kind of stuck in these modes, and just note it, just notice it, just label it, not fix it, not change it, not control it. Just be like, oh, there is a lot of anger in the mind right now. Or there is a lot of anxiety in the mind. Not so much I'm anxious, but oh, that's interesting. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of worry in the mind. There's a lot of restlessness in the body. What if I linger with that, stick with that, notice that, practice with that? So I'll close with a quote by Ajahn Chah. And this is, I think, a really great embodiment of equanimity, this practice. He says, try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a still forest pool. All kinds of wonderful animals will come and drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of them. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha.